You're having a good time on the couch with your friends. You're having a good time in the bed alone. You're having a good time watching TV. Let us ruin your day. Yay!
Welcome to Now It's Ruined, the podcast for people who hate enjoying things. I'm Kate Bridle.
And I'm Larkin Harrington.
We've had a lot of technical difficulties. The most, everything is conspiring against us. Larkin doesn't have internet. She's on a hotspot. But as we were just saying, it has made us very salty and ready to be mad. So that, you know, we're ready to shit on Christmas.
I am always ready to shit on Christmas.
Okay, great. Well, that answers a question I have for you later, but we'll dig into that a little more in a little while. Some housekeeping, some exciting stuff, but also just some contributions to the Colin Hanks jar, because we're trying to do that more. And Larkin shared a fact on our November bonus episode about Colin Hanks, but I wanted you to share it again for all of the people about what he said in regards to his being interviewed about the John Candy documentary.
Yes, correct. He is quoted to have said that all white men over 40 should be in therapy.
Yes, they should.
Hard agree. I mean, I would add all, but you know,
as early as possible.
As early,
you can afford it. Yeah, I already put money in there, but I didn't say I was going to put money in every time we give a new novel fact. I said I would put it in every time we mention him. So
that's
we just
true.
Mentioned him again. We watched the documentary, Nate and I did, and it was really good.
I just really appreciate that I got that text from you that you were like, "It's really amazing. Colin did a great job."
He did a really good job. It was just, I thought, a really like beautiful and kind and like lovely, but very real and honest kind of exploration of John Candy. So definitely recommend. It's called I Like Me. It's on Prime. Update on numbers and the interstate wars. Our numbers kept up really strong in November. So our listenership in October really jumped, and it was far and away the highest listenership month we'd had so far. And we were like, well, we're probably not going to match that number in November because we're only putting out two episodes instead of three. Like, it might be a fluke, whatever. But instead, we passed our October number halfway through November and kept going. As of today, which is the 9th of December, we have already passed our November number. It's crazy. It's crazy.
I'm still in disbelief about it.
I know, we don't know what happened. We think you're spreading us around during the holidays, but then it hasn't stopped since since Thanksgiving ended. So it's like, I don't know, we're just blown away. We were already like blown away by getting that number in 1 month, and now we've done it in just over a week. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
And then also, we looked at our Spotify Wrapped for Creators, and you put us in the top 10% of all new podcasts on Spotify this year, and in the top 3% of shares of all podcasts on Spotify. Woo! Like, we were not expecting that at all. I was like, well, I'll peek at it. Thank you so much. It's really cool to see how many of you are digging what we do. But if you're here right now, please know you are still very much in on the ground floor. So please keep spreading the word. Tell the friends. Tell the friends.
Doesn't have to be your friend. Tell
them. Yeah, just tell all the friends. Keep spreading the word. I've also noticed that these new listeners have not really been reflected in our numbers on Patreon and Instagram. So please go follow us over there. And you know, the holidays are the perfect time to share all of the horrific facts that you've learned from us. And you know, I'm about to give you some more holiday themed ones that you can use. So you're welcome. Okay, so this episode is on me. I'm going to ruin Christmas. I recognize there are a lot of other important holidays happening around this time. It is not just Christmas. I don't mean to make it all about Christmas, but if I'm going to ruin a holiday,
yeah,
Christmas is going to be the one I'm taking down. So yeah, that's right. I have enlisted in the war on Christmas alongside comrades like those plain red Starbucks cups and customer service reps who dare to say happy holidays.
That's
I know
me.
We're boycotting Starbucks right now. With that, though, I do want to say I don't actually hate Christmas. I've grown up with fond Christmas memories. I still like decorating. I've got my little Christmas sweater on right now. Everything feels a little extra cozy when you have like some lights and a tree and stuff, but I am a little extra prickly about the holidays this year because it's the first Christmas without my mom. So I'm like, Larkin, you have said you're a Grinch, but is there a reason for that? Or you just don't like the consumerism or what?
Yeah, it's that. It's always been really stressful because my family is really big. It's never felt fully cheery because not everybody's there. There's drama, there's, you know, sadness. It's just stress. By the time November hits, I'm like, I have not gotten a single Christmas present. Every year I say, I'm going to start in goddamn March, and then I never do.
I relate to the stress of gift giving. I'm not like, gift giving is definitely not my love language. I like doing it if I see something that makes me think of somebody. But I, like you, am terrible about doing that throughout the year and then like accumulating it for Christmas. Anyway, there are a ton of routes that I could have gone down to ruin Christmas. And since I'm also doing this month's bonus episode, I had to make decisions about what I wanted to do for which. And I kind of went on vibes, to be honest, with this episode. And I went in a direction that in the end is maybe a little unexpected, though it wound up slightly less cohesive than I was hoping for. But it still works. It still works. Hopefully you all enjoy it and find it interesting. So I won't be talking about how the holiday was used by the church to drag pagans into the fold, or how it morphed into the capitalist monstrosity that it is today. We'll save those for other years. Larkin, maybe next year you can do Christmas. And you,
I will happily.
So instead, I'm going to do three different kind of more mini ruins. Three short Grables is what I kept thinking of, in Adventure Time.
Yes, I thought Grables immediately. I was like, oh, Grables.
We're going to do three short Grables. Two short Grables and a medium Grable. We're going to talk about some creepy Christmas stuff before I get into a story of some of the original colonizers. I will say I did use some Wikipedia on this one, especially for the like Christmas legend stuff. But I also used other sources I trusted, but I verified. And then on the longer stuff later, the last thing I talk about, I used much more reliable. I actually even paid for an article this time. So you're welcome. So this journey is going to take us to a few different areas, but we're going to start in France.
In France.
Okay. France.
You have Christmas in France.
Christmas.
If you get that reference, let's be friends. So France is the origin of one of, I think, the most upsetting Christmas figures, a cannibalistic scarecrow named Hans Trapp.
I'm sorry. I do not recall Hans Trapp.
You're about to learn all about him. And I feel actually like the description cannibalistic scarecrow, which is used on all sorts of articles about him, is actually a little imprecise because he sounds like he's a scarecrow who eats other scarecrows, which is not the case.
I know. I'm like, wait a minute. You eat people for sure, right?
He eats children. Yeah, human
children. Right, right, right. So, of course it's children.
So yeah, precision of language is important, but I also understand why everyone's using it because the phrase Christmas cannibal scarecrow is very catchy and fun.
Very, so, yeah.
Hans's legend begins in the Wissembourg region of Alsace in France. And this area is on the border between France and Germany. But way back in the 15th century, it was just all part of the Holy Roman Empire. About 15 kilometers north of Wissembourg was a pink sandstone fortress, which just sounds kind of, I don't know. I'm like, that sounds like somewhere Ariel should live. Maybe just because it has the word sand. I know sandstone is an actual sand. And I know this is also landlocked, so it's not a great place for her. But
she's dragged herself over dry land to get to her sandstone palace.
Just her arms.
She's all dried out.
This fortress was called Berwartsten Castle. Berwartsten.
It's a W?
Yeah, it's probably Berwartsten. Wartsten. We're just warming up with the difficulty of the words. I'm already in trouble. This area was part of what was called the Palatinate, which is a section of current-day Germany that's just like a region of the Holy Roman Empire. And this region had a leader called an elector. In 1480, the elector awarded Berwartsten Castle to a German knight known as Hans von Trotha. Hans was born around 1450, and he had proven himself as a commander for the Holy Roman Empire, and he was actually awarded two castles, and he wound up promoted to Marshal of the Prince Electors of the Palatinate. So take that for what you will.
Good heavens.
Before the Holy Roman Empire had seized Berwartsten Castle in 1450, it belonged to monks. And when it was awarded to Hans, the abbot, or the like head monk, objected to one of the electors in the area. He was like, can we please have this back? Because it belongs to us. But he was rejected, and Hans got to keep the castle. The monk's insubordination had pissed Hans off, and he was not about to let it stand. So he built a dam and cut off the water supply to Wissembourg, which is where the monks lived. And as a bonus, he diverted a bunch of the water to flood the abbot's land.
Ooh. That's some catty bullshit.
Yeah, he was like, fuck you, fuck this town, and fuck your land. So now the monks are really pissed. So they bust up the dam, which actually winds up flooding Wessenburg now. So they've caused a flood in the whole town now. And the abbot was also just like, fuck Hans von Trotha, fuck this guy. So he starts tattling on him to the Holy Roman Emperor. But since Hans was a good soldier, the emperor didn't really care what he did. So the abbot had to go over the emperor's head to the real top dog, the Pope.
Uh-oh. Calling him Big Daddy.
Big Pope Daddy. It actually took the abbot 8 years to win favor with a pope. So he tried with a different pope and the pope was like, nah. But he finally succeeded with Pope Alexander VI. And Hans von Trotha was summoned to appear at a tribunal in Rome. He's getting called into the principal's office. Like, mm-mm. But Hans wrote back in response to this summons and was like, look, I'm loyal to the church and everything, but I ain't coming to that. Like, make me, basically.
Just no.
And then he also threw in this letter that he found the Pope immoral.
Oh,
that got Hans's ass excommunicated from the church. You're gonna just insult the Pope? Not gonna go well for you.
You can't be doing that.
And when you're excommunicated from the church in the Holy Roman Empire, you're basically just like not a member of society anymore in a large part of the world in Europe. So that kind of was not great for Hans. But his buddy, the elector, who had taken his side before, helped him out again and sent Hans to the French royal court during the Italian Wars, which were exactly what they sounded like. It was a war about dominating Italy, mostly fought between France and Spain. It was like, who's going to get this territory in Italy? And Hans was awarded the title of Golden Knight by Louis XII of France. So Hans died in Berwartsten. I'm going to die in this episode. Okay.
Cause of death, trying to pronounce European.
Oh, God. Okay. He died in that castle in 1503. And after his death, the myth building about him started in earnest. And he was painted as this ruthless, bloodthirsty, violent man bent on terrorizing everyone in his path. And maybe he was. I don't know. He certainly killed a lot of people. But the fact that he was excommunicated from the church definitely didn't help this image of him. And he was so power hungry, it was said, that he made a pact with the devil himself. So if you don't like the Pope, you must be in league with the devil.
Obviously.
So the legend goes that after his excommunication, Hans found himself stripped of the power that he had sacrificed his very soul to gain. And he retreated to the mountains of Bavaria, where he had endless time to brood and think about his hatred of all mankind. Basically, he's becoming an incel, except he hates everyone, not just women. This is why we need to talk about the male loneliness epidemic, Clark. Otherwise, we got cannibalistic scarecrows showing up, eating our kids.
Coming out of the mountains, Gollum style.
So he's brooding. He's mad.
Right.
One day, a young shepherd boy had the misfortune of crossing paths with Hans, who stabbed the poor lad to death with a sharp stick before dragging his body back to his mountain lair and consuming his flesh.
Oh, no. Why just a sharpened stick?
I don't know. I guess it's what he had around.
Oh, cruel and unusual. I like that that's what disturbs me. I'm so used to the monsters in the mountains eating the flesh of children that I'm like, sure. But
it's the stick that really gets
it's crude and painful. Good heavens. All right.
Yeah. So he kills and eats this kid. And for this abhorrent crime, God punished Hans by turning him into a scarecrow.
Of all things.
Interesting choice by God. I'm not sure what that's about.
He was having a goofy day, you know. Yeah. He's like, I'm tired of snakes.
And salt. Piles of salt.
They're so out.
This scarecrow now wanders the forests, ready to eat any naughty children who have strayed from the path of goodness. So watch out.
How does he wander? Pogo sticking around? Like,
no, he's like the scarecrow from Wizard of Oz.
Oh, like he's got legs. Got it. I was thinking Howl's Moving Castle. Yeah.
That would be a lot creepier, to be honest.
I think so.
It's kind of Jeepers Creepers-y, too. That's what all this evoked for me. But Hans von Trotha's name eventually mutated into Hans Trapp, and he's said to have a white beard and a pointed hood. and he's wearing a big black coat and big black boots that make a lot of noise when he walks. And this is actually part of his name. So the word trappen, or troppen, I'm sorry if I'm saying it wrong, means to make noise while walking to chase away spirits. But in this case, it's the spirit who's making the noise. So you might be asking, what does this have to do with Christmas, Kate? Hans is one of St. Nick's sidekicks in this part of the world. So apparently St. Nick is just willing to take in cannibals who made literal deals with the devil. He's like, that's fine. He's a very open-minded employer, St. Nick. Maybe he gets a tax incentive or something.
Wow. Super chill up there.
Yeah, this guy needs help reintegrating into society.
Yeah.
No worries that he kills and eats children. He's not even necessarily called Hans Trapp in the legends, but there is a figure known to be Hans Trapp, which is called the Black Knight, who hangs out with Santa, essentially, and rounds up the naughty kids around Christmas to eat them. Merry, merry.
Wow.
Times.
Merry, fun, happy. Yeah. These myths are so ridiculous to me, because saying them out loud, you're like, oh yeah, and also he has a scarecrow that's also like a knight, and he'll eat your kids? I don't know. That's wild. I love it.
Because some guy got excommunicated for calling the Pope immoral 500 years ago. So, and this is not, we're not just like laughing at France. Like, the French are so stupid. Like, we have these legends all over the world. This is not, we're not trying to shit on France. So that was Grable number one.
I like that Grable.
Okay, so my second Grable is about a classic Christmas carol, Good King Wenceslas.
Next
one. Yeah. So when you think of this carol, Good King Wenceslas, what do you think of? Or like, what's your image of King Wenceslas?
He's like a man of the people, kind of, I guess, is like in my mind. He, I can't think of it. I was like, short and strong and even. No, that's not.
It's the snow is deep and crisp and even.
Right. There it is. There it is. I was like, he's not short and strong. He's good. He's a good guy.
Yeah.
He's nice.
Yeah, it's right there in his name.
People like him. Solid. He's good.
I like that you're continuing. Like, I was ready to take the mic back from you so long ago, and you're just continuing to say the same thing in different ways, and I want you to keep going.
He came down. Where did he come down from? He came down from the shores of Sweden. I don't know. I don't remember the lyrics.
It's not the shores of Sweden.
It has to rhyme with even.
It's the Feast of Stephen. It's the date that he's looking out.
I have the wrong...
I want you to rewrite this carol with your memory. Sing it right now.
Good King Wenceslas came down from the shores of Sweden. Bringing gifts from Christmas Town. He was short and strong and even. I sang this as a child in choir so many times. I've sung this in adult choirs. Why can't I remember the lyrics? Why can't I think of the lyrics?
Holy shit. Ooh, okay. Good King Wenceslas looked out. Look on the out. Feast of Stephen, where the snow lay roundabout, deep and crisp and even.
Close. I was so close.
And there are lots more lyrics. My first thought when I hear about Good King Wenceslas is actually that moment in Love Actually. And I know we have trouble with Love Actually for good reason. But when Hugh Grant's going door to door because he's trying to find the secretary to tell her that he loves her or whatever. And the kid is like, he's caroling. And then Hugh Grant just starts singing Good King Wenceslas. And then his driver is standing behind him and suddenly pipes in with this like deep booming voice.
Yes.
And Hugh Grant keeps singing, but just like slowly looks back at him.
And now we're hearing all about how terrible Hugh Grant is as a person. Mm-hmm. Anyway.
Yes. Opposite of a boy cat for Hugh Grant.
Opposite.
We haven't boy catted anyone in a while. Pedro Pascal, easy boy cat.
easy.
Outspoken about the trans issues and all the other issues. He was marching in the No Kings protests a couple of months ago. He's like, absolutely, yes, hot boy doing hot boy shit. So anyway, I looked up the full lyrics. I was like, is there anything secretly dark in these? Because we don't know verse 10 or whatever. We only sing the first part. And no, it's not. It's just about a kindly king who shares food and wealth with some peasants on the day after Christmas, which is the day of the Feast of Stephen. And St. Stephen, just as a bonus little tidbit here, is alleged to be the first Christian martyr. So yeah, the carol is about a king sharing food with poor people on St. Stephen's Day. Lovely.
Lovely.
But the story of the real King Wenceslas is not so lovely. He wasn't actually a king. He was a duke. Duke Wenceslas I of Bohemia. And it seems like Wenceslas or Wenceslaus is a Latinized version of his Czech name, which is Václav. He is from the area that is now the Czech Republic, and he's a very important figure in Czech culture. He was known as Václav the Good. He did have a very positive reputation, which he gained by being very pious and spreading Christianity throughout the land, of course, also just being, yes, but also being kind to his people. So I am going to call him Wenceslas from now on, just so we remember who we're talking about here. He was born near Prague around 907 AD, and he was raised as a Christian by his grandmother, Saint Ludmilla. She was also a saint. At this time, Christendom, which was the group of countries unified by their belief in Christianity, was still intact, and it was basically all of Europe and a chunk of Russia. And it was made up of Catholics and Eastern Orthodox folks, and they were all united. Eventually, in 1054, the Catholics and the Eastern Orthodox people split in what was called the Great Schism, or the East-West Schism, and the Catholics wound up with pretty much everything from Poland westward, and then the Eastern Orthodox Church had a smaller presence over towards Russia. This whole story takes place before the schism. I just wanted to mention it because I thought it was interesting, and I didn't know about it.
It is.
So Wenceslas, that's a tough one. His dad and paternal grandparents, Ludmilla and her husband, were Christian, but his mom, Drahomira, was a pagan. And she, badass name. I think it's like in some languages, it's Dragomir. Like, it's very like, ooh. So Drahomira was baptized when she married Wenceslas's dad, but she still held her alliances with the pagans of Bohemia. She is not down with this Christianity business. She's like, mm-mm. When Wenceslas was 13, his father died in battle, and his grandmother, Ludmilla, became the regent of Bohemia because Wenceslas wasn't old enough yet to become the duke. So she is kind of the stand-in ruler of the area. And allegedly, Drahomira was not happy with this and had Ludmilla assassinated in 921 AD. Yeah. Ooh. Some people say that Ludmilla was strangled with her own veil, which just seems like a really poorly planned assassination. Like, you didn't bring a dagger or any poison or like a little fly by night. But whatever. I think it's also just dramatic. It's like strangled with her own veil. Like,
yeah.
It's a dramatic image. After Ludmilla's death, Drahomira was in charge, and she was apparently oppressing the Christians in the kingdom. And she and Hans Trapp actually have a lot in common, or Hans von Trotha, I should say, in that they dared to be anti-church, and they got their legends just totally dragged for it. So she was also painted as ruthlessly ambitious. She allegedly made a deal with the devil for power. Same narrative. And like, listen, having your mother-in-law assassinated, not cute. Not a great look. I'm not saying she was a gem, but I don't think she would have been painted as so like deeply evil if she weren't pagan.
Right. And like, what do we know? What if her mother-in-law was like a real piece of work who was like, you know, one of the crazy early Christians that was like, if you don't wear this shoe on a Tuesday, we'll burn you.
So eventually Wenceslas turns 18 and he's of age to become duke. And at this point, Drahomira wasn't going to give the power over to Wenceslas, but the remaining Christian nobles in the kingdom backed him and they instigated a rebellion against her, putting Wenceslas in power and banishing his mom.
Okay.
Wenceslas, as I said, was very pious. He's said to have taken a vow of virginity, and he was all about spreading Christianity everywhere he could. But he was also known as very compassionate and kind. Apparently, he paid particular attention to caring for orphans, widows, and prisoners, and he opposed slavery. So there was that.
I mean, the bar's on the floor, but thank you.
Right. Wenceslas the Good had a younger brother, Boleslav the Cruel.
Oh.
Like his mother, Boleslav was power hungry and anti-Christian, allegedly. He was influenced by their mother and conspired to murder his big brother, Wenceslas. So he was helped out by some nobles who did not like that Wenceslas had bent the knee to the king of Germany to avoid German invasion. Mm. And Wenceslas was on his way to church, of course he was, when his brother and three henchmen attacked him. And the henchmen stabbed Wenceslas on the steps of the church. And as he fell, his brother ran him through with a lance and murdered him.
Jankies.
Better than strangling someone with their veil, I would say. More certain. Once Boleslav was on the throne, he reverted to Christianity anyway. So his mom's plotting didn't get her the anti-Christian kid in charge of Bohemia that she wanted. According to legend, as she sat in a carriage in a square in Prague cursing Christianity, the mouth of hell opened beneath her and she was sucked down into the flames because the devil had claimed her for the deal that she had made with him all of those years ago.
I mean, what a departure.
Yeah, in a carriage and just was like, mouth of hell is taking me. Yes, it's the way to go out.
It is. Good for you.
Yeah. And that spot apparently is a landmark in Prague. And for a while it was fenced off so nobody could walk over it and like tempt the mouth of hell to open again. Now I think it's just different colored bricks. So it's still marked like this spot where she allegedly was sucked into hell.
Oh, I want to go dance upon it.
Yeah, Prague, I want to go really badly anyway, because there's so much interesting history there. Like, it's a fascinating spot and so beautiful. But anyway, yes, next time you hear Good King Wenceslas, or Larkin's version of it, just remember that the real King Wenceslas was brutally murdered by his own brother on the steps of a church.
Yay.
So now I'm going to get into the real substance of what I want to discuss today. So we're going to travel from France and Bohemia over to Iceland. It's funny, as soon as I started researching this episode, that thing started happening where like Iceland was everywhere all of a sudden. Two of my friends who do not know each other straight up went to Iceland like while I was researching this.
Weird.
Like, probably because I spoke about it out loud. My phone also served me content from a creator who lives in Iceland, Elisa Hansen, who does this funny series about Icelandic horses and if she would date them if she were a horse. She's very specific about that.
Right.
I posted one of her videos to my stories with like a comment about how I was doing research about Iceland, and she very kindly reached out and offered to help. And so we're Instagram buddies now. She's great. I recommend going to follow her. I will pop her link in the show notes. And so I reached out to her for help with some pronunciation of some of the words and names that I'm going to be saying in this part of the episode. As a caveat, she's a Dutch expat, so she's not actually a native Icelandic speaker, but she definitely is getting more in the zone than I ever would have. I will play some of them for you, and I'm going to use others to just help me with my pronunciation. And I just wanted to shout her out. So thank you, Elisa. And she's really funny and great. So yeah, go follow her. I guess I've officially warmed to the Dutch.
It's official. It's happened.
So, in Iceland, on the 13 nights leading up to Christmas, children put their shoes out on the windowsill in the hopes that they will get treats from the 13 merry brothers known as the Yule Lads. And if the kids have been good, they'll get candy in their shoes. And if they've been bad, the Yule Lads will give them a rotting potato.
Oh,
this just makes me wonder how many parents have given their shitty kid 13 rotting potatoes in a row. You'd need a whole sack of rotting potatoes to do it. But if your kid's shitty enough, it might be worth it.
And I've left this outside and watched them rot in preparation. You little.
I rotted these potatoes just for you.
Just for you.
OK, I've got my first word here. So I'm going to just play it.
Jólasveinar.
I'll try this again. She's got a nice voice, too.
She does. I want her to have a book.
Jólasveinar.
Jólasveinar, I think. Icelandic. The Yule Lads are currently portrayed as delightfully mischievous kind of little creatures who all resemble Santa Claus. They have red and white clothes and cute little beards and hats. And they're like little elves, basically.
Just little happy guys. Okay.
Yeah. Elves and dwarves are a big part of Scandinavian culture, and I know Iceland is a part of the Scandinavian peninsula, but they are culturally Scandinavian for reasons we will get into in just a little while. And elves and dwarves featured heavily in Norse mythology, including the Norse creation story. Oh. So like the origin of the world in the Norse creation myth includes elves and dwarves, and those Norse elves and dwarves were J.R.R. Tolkien's inspiration for the elves and dwarves in The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings, which I didn't know.
No way.
Yeah, he even took some character names like Durin and Gandalf from Old Norse myths and poems. Gandalf, it's not exactly Gandalf. It's something different, slightly different. But Durin actually literally is like one of the dwarves' names in a Norse myth, I think.
Cool. I had no... Yeah. Oh, the more Tolkien tidbits I get, the happier little nerd I am.
I know, me too. But the Yule lads were not always the jolly little tricksters that they are today. Originally, they were big, scary trolls who were used to scare children into good behavior, and they were so scary that in 1746, the Icelandic government actually prohibited people from telling stories about them to frighten their kids. And
oh,
I really tried to dig into like what happened that the Icelandic government felt the need to step in, but I just couldn't. I couldn't figure it out, unfortunately, because I was like, something had to have gone down to make the Icelandic government be like, guys, you have to stop.
Whoa. Stop traumatizing the kids.
They're so terrified. I don't even know what. They can't leave the house. I don't know. I don't know what happened to the Icelandic kids. If anybody knows, please tell us. I want to hear some of those stories too.
Yeah, I want to hear the horror of the trolls. What were they called? Obviously, they weren't the Yule lads.
I don't know what they were called when they were in troll form, but I will tell you some of their names and things in a minute here. The original Yule lads were supposed to be big scary creatures, but none of the lads were as scary as their mother. Grýla.
Ooh.
Grýla is a troll-like monster who lives in the caves in the mountains with her lazy-ass husband, Lepaluri. So yeah, apparently her husband is just like known for not doing jack shit around the house. He's just lazy. And, you know, that would turn me into a troll too if we had 13 kids especially.
Yeah. Don't be a layabout.
What the hell, dude?
What the hell? Get out.
We have 13 boys.
This cave isn't going to clean itself.
Grýla is supposed to be the most terrifying figure in the stories. There's like an illustrator who was like, if I draw her, kids have to leave the room because they're so freaked out. Like she is, whatever the stories were, she's the reason that kids were like so terrified. And she usually hangs out in her cave in the mountains. But around Christmas time, she descends and hunts for naughty children. And when she finds them, she snatches them up. She takes them back to her cave and she makes them into stew and eats them.
This is my type of girl. I love these girls in these stories.
Yeah. She's pretty similar to Hans Trapp, but like she's a woman and a mother. So it's like, of course, it's even more egregious that she's eating children, right? I don't know if the Yule lads eat the kids' stew. I'm not sure, but the lazy husband definitely does. And the Yule lads are known to kidnap kids and bring them to her to make the stew. So they're participating in the child murder and eating one way or another. They contribute to it. So this family of Christmas terrors also has a cat, Jola Kurturin. The emphasis, she gave me this tip, the emphasis in Icelandic is always on the first syllable. So you never...
Interesting.
So Jola Kurturin, I think, known as the Christmas cat.
The Christmas cat. Jola Kurturin.
Doesn't that sound cute? But it's not actually that cute because this classist asshole eats children who doesn't get something new to wear for Christmas.
No, Jola Kurturin, no.
Rich kids don't get eaten, but the poor kids getting munched up by this cat.
A bourgeoisie cat.
Yes, the bourgeois cat. Okay, so each Yule lad has his own preferred means of causing trouble and mischief. And some of their names hint at what their little chosen activity is. And these names are like creepy enough when you picture them as little gnomes or whatever. But when you picture them as big, gross trolls, it's even worse. Maybe it's not actually. I don't know which is worse. And like these activities, just I don't care for them.
Well, so, you keep calling them activities.
Well, just wait. You're going to hear. They each come down and they do a different thing on their night.
Right.
Besides just the candy and potato situation. They come to bother the townspeople. So, for example, the first Yule lad, Stekjestar, shows up on the night of December 12th and sucks the milk out of sheep.
Oh, okay, that little elf gnome, reasonable. You'd be like, oh.
Still don't love it.
I don't like that, but maybe he's a hungry little guy. But a big troll sucking on some sheep teats?
No thanks. Mm-mm. And then the next night, his brother Giljagr steals the froth off the top of milk buckets. So he's just eating the froth.
Uh-uh.
Frothy little mouth.
No.
So their names in English don't really communicate what they do, so I use the Icelandic ones. But then there are spoon liquor, pot liquor, and bowl liquor. Guess what they do?
Take a wild guess. Just like the leftover?
Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah, basically.
I like that their mischief is just food related so far.
My favorite is probably sausage swiper, because
that's hands down my favorite.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
Sausage swiper.
Sausage swiper. Yep.
Whereas my two least favorites would have to be window peeper and door sniffer.
Mm-mm. Door sniffer is the most egregious.
I knew that that would be the one that you really didn't like. You don't like when people sniff things in general.
Anything. But why a door? You're doing that just to upset me personally.
I think he's like sniffing at the door to smell if there are any leftovers or anything he can maybe come in and steal. Window peeper's just straight up looking in people's windows.
That's just
peeping Tom.
Actually my nightmare.
I know, right? Literal nightmare. Opening a window, like your curtains in the dark and seeing someone out there. Ugh. So as we mentioned, most of the Yule Lads activities center around stealing food that's like left out somehow. They eat leftover crusts, little bits of food on spoons, froth on the milk buckets that have been left out. And this could be a way to encourage kids to do their chores, I would guess. It's like, hey, if you leave out the milk, you know. But when I originally planned this episode, I thought I had read something about the Yule Lad legend being tied to discouraging like waste and protecting your food. And then I was like, perfect. I can transition from that into talking about how their resources would be different if their environment had been better protected. But then I couldn't find anything about that again. And then the legend originated way later than I thought. And then the environmental issues haven't really been tied to a lack of resources. So that all fell apart. But I was too far into the script to pivot. And I still think this is interesting. So this is what we're doing. Please accept it. And I actually do feel like shoehorning this in is kind of in the spirit of the origins of this podcast, which is like us finding any excuse to tell people something miserable at social gatherings. If we were at dinner and somebody was like, oh, have you heard about the Icelandic Yule Lads? We'd be like, Iceland, you say, you know.
Actually.
Their environment's fucked, and that's because ... right?
Yeah.
So for a good few hundred years, the Vikings were some of the premier colonizers in Europe. From the 9th to the 11th century, they burst forth from their homelands in Sweden, Norway, and Denmark to explore, trade, raid, pillage, and settle. And the trading, raiding, and pillaging, they did absolutely all over the place, from Canada to Russia, and even in the Middle East, which I didn't know. The Vikings were going through waterways, and they were in the Middle East. Their settling was a little more limited, but they still inhabited a ton of land in England, Ireland, France, northeastern Europe, Russia, Greenland, Iceland, and even a little bit in Canada. The Vikings were actually the first European explorers to reach North America, arriving around the year 1,500 years before that fuckwad Christopher Columbus. The Vikings also stayed in some places only seasonally, apparently. This is what they did in Iceland initially, actually. So they'd built temporary settlements, and then they would head back to their homeland in Scandinavia for other seasons. They were also seasonal in their raiding and their traveling, because hanging out on uncovered ships in winter sucks. So they would usually set out to mess up the rest of the world in the springtime. And to quote our beloved Britannica, during the Viking period, Scandinavian countries seem to have possessed a practically inexhaustible surplus of manpower. So they were just pumping out baby Vikings. And they also just seemed to have a ton of really capable leaders. Basically, they were just like a society of people made to raid. And their skill and their efficiency at raiding earned them the name Vikingur, which means pirate in the old Scandinavian languages. So Viking. At home, they were primarily farmers, though, of course, some of them also, you know, they built ships, they fished, they did other stuff to maintain a society. And at this point, I must quote visitnorway.com, which says, quote, they were warriors, looters, and barbarians, yet they were also farmers, family members, traders, shipbuilders, and lovers. I just like, why lovers? Like, yeah, I don't know. Yeah. The like word lover rubs me the wrong way for some reason.
Oh, same. And it's strange because they're very much romanticized in like everything that depicts them. It's like, yeah, they're bloody horrible warriors, and then they just come home and fuck.
Yeah, yeah. It's just they're lovers. Even their violence is romanticized. It's mm-hmm. like because they were so badass, they were able to go out and do this. And I mean, they were a group of right. badasses, but it is interesting because it's like, yeah, they brutalized a lot of fucking people all over the place and were like just stealing shit. You know, it's like,
yeah,
I mean, they had their own society that ran so well also, and they were producing so much themselves. They were successful farmers. It's like, why do you have to go and fuck up other people and steal their stuff? So the Vikings' shipbuilding ability was one of the things that made them such effective colonizers. Their method of building ships with overlapping planks of oak was adopted by other cultures and influenced shipbuilding for centuries. They built tons of different types of watercraft for different purposes, but the most famous ones, the ones they used for raids, were their Viking longships. And these are the long, narrow ones you can picture with like a bunch of dudes' shields sticking out the side. They're open. They've got like a figurehead on either end. They're basically big ass canoes.
Right.
These ships were double-ended, which meant that they could reverse, which made them more maneuverable, which is handy in tight waterways, but also in when you're navigating ice and icy water. The ships were also light enough to be carried, though I don't know how many men it took, but probably just however many men are in the crew, you can just pop it up on your shoulder and carry it. And they also had shallow drafts. And the draft is how far a ship's hull extends below the waterline. So a shallow drafted ship can operate in shallower water because it doesn't go as far below the waterline. And that allows Vikings to navigate more waterways and get right up onto the shore, which is handy for this hit and run style raiding that they were known for. So they hop out of the boat, you murder some people, you force yourself on some women, you steal some shit, you hop right back in, easy peasy, you know, spreading terror and DNA all over the place.
Sowing your lovers. Wild oats. Lovers.
They weren't all bad. For example, women were allowed to get divorced in Viking society.
Right.
Which is interesting. Right. Yeah. It's a real trip. Considering that the US didn't have no-fault divorce till the fucking 70s. I mean, the Vikings, it wasn't no fault. They did require a reason. Yeah. Still. But despite this, the Vikings were also hella violent, as we have mentioned, and as everybody knows. I mean, those Norse creation myths that I mentioned earlier were riddled with violent imagery. According to them, the world was created by three brothers tearing apart a giant, using his blood to make the sea and his skull for the sky. So,
you know, right. Wow.
There we go. And they were also pretty fucking classist. So one of the old Norse poems describes social classes as being divinely ordained. So they believed that like your social status was ordained by the gods. And they were also active slavers, which a lot of people don't know and doesn't get talked about. And this is partially because they didn't call slaves slaves. They called them thralls. But they were slaves. They used slaves. They traded slaves. And then also, this is not to do with the slavery necessarily, but the first ever Viking, recorded Viking raid was on a monastery in England. So they weren't terribly discerning about who they were being violent toward either, like a bunch of monks. And they were just like, here we come.
Don't care who you are.
Not all Vikings were created equal in their violence. According to a study that was published last year in the Journal of Anthropological Archaeology, Norwegian Vikings were more violent than other Vikings. And the way that they determined this is they examined archaeological and skeletal evidence from Danish and Norwegian Viking societies. They don't mention Sweden. They do, but they don't. I don't know why exactly. So they studied archaeological and skeletal evidence from Danish and Norwegian Viking societies and found that Norwegian Viking skeletons had way more skeletal trauma that indicated extreme violence. And they also found a shitload more weapons in Norway and the Norwegian occupied areas. So they were making more weapons for a reason, presumably. And most violence in the Danish Viking societies seems to have been related to official executions, whereas the Norwegian Vikings were apparently just beating the shit out of each other and everybody else all the time. So they found a lot of traumatized Viking skeletons in Norway, and they're pretty sure that those people were killed by fellow Norwegian Vikings because their bodies weren't usually transported home if they died elsewhere. So they assume that whoever is being found in Norway, they were killed there. And other places aren't really invading Norway because there's a bunch of fucking Vikings there. So why would you do that? They're badass enough when they're just like mobile on a boat and hopping out and killing you. How do you think they are on their home turf?
Right. Mm-hmm. Like their own playing ground. Just don't go over there.
and with their women around who also were badasses.
Yeah. Which I think is partly why we get to romanticize it too, because we're like, oh, women were also really badass and tough and beautiful. I want to be hot and deadly.
Isn't that just what we all want, to be hot and deadly? That is interesting. And I think it's also that we have such robust records of the Vikings because they kept records and, you know, they had written language. And so we have a lot of information about them as well and about how their society actually worked, which in a lot of ways, just like Scandinavia is now, was very progressive. So yes, it's presumed that Norwegian Vikings were killing each other more. And this might be partially because Norwegian Vikings were more clan-based and less unified than Danish Vikings were. So Danish society was kind of all one unified society of Danish Vikings, whereas the Norwegian Vikings were split into clans that may have had conflict with each other. It was these extra violent Norwegian Vikings who wound up settling Iceland. But I suppose the good news is there were not people there already for them to be violent toward. So there was no one for them to conquer.
Oh, really?
On Iceland. There's no indication, no evidence that there were ever any indigenous people on Iceland. And actually, the only indigenous mammal to Iceland is the Arctic fox.
No.
No other. The first known inhabitants of Iceland are thought to have been a group of Irish monks known as the Peipar. These monks are referenced in texts written by the Vikings who settled Iceland. So that's how we know that they existed. That's the only evidence we have of them. There's no actual archaeological evidence of the monks, but apparently they had lived there for a while and then left because the Vikings said they just found bells and books and stuff like that on the island.
Spooky, but cool. I don't know why it's spooky, but
the idea of like Vikings finding evidence, like that's so ancient. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It feels so, that would be a cool horror movie. The Vikings come to Iceland and they're haunted by some, it should be nature, some being of nature that haunts them. As I mentioned, the Vikings had settled Iceland seasonally before, but Ingólfur Arnarson is credited as being the first permanent settler there. And he came to Iceland with his family and his blood brother, which is like a brotherhood formed by allegiance. And it basically was like a symbolic bond that they were bound to avenge each other in case of trouble. So this probably happened a lot between, you know, warriors who were fighting together. And it was maybe helpful, particularly in that clan-based Norwegian society, because if you have the leader of another clan as your blood brother, you have that clan to back you up in case of conflict or to avenge you if something happens. That clan now can't attack you. So that's one off the list of people who might come for you.
A nice safety net.
Arnarson's blood brother has a name that involves an H followed by a J followed by an O with an umlaut. And then there's his last name, which has an Icelandic letter in it that I have zero idea how to pronounce. And so I'm going to attempt to say it for comedic effect. And then I'm going to try and make Larkin say it. And then I'll just play Elisa's actual pronunciation, not feeling confident that I'm going to even get in the zone. Okay, so here it is.
Let's see what I can do.
Are you going to try it first?
No, you go. Well, what do you...
Okay, I'll try. Hjolifer Hrodmarsson.
It's just that you're so, like, timid about it.
I am. Go for it more aggressively then.
Okay.
Viking style.
Viking style? Okay. Hjörlifur. There, I feel comfortable with that. Hjörlifur Hrodmarsson.
The fact that you tried it 9 times and then were like, there, I feel comfortable with that, after you just sounded the most uncomfortable I've ever heard you, and then kept trying it, so clearly you were not comfortable with it, was amazing. Hjörlifur Hrodmarsson. Yep, that's that.
Hrodmarsson.
Oh, you're putting some... Let's see what Elisa has to say to us about this.
Hjörlifur Hrodmarsson.
Hjörlifur. We did that. Hjörlifur.
Yeah.
We did that. Okay. Hrodmarsson. Hrodmarsson.
Hrodmarsson. I don't see that as a D. Interesting.
Anyway, I'm just going to call him Double H.
There we go.
Double H settled along the southern coast of Iceland near a mountain that looks like maybe it's named after him, but is somehow even more complicated looking to me. So like when I see this word, my brain breaks a little bit. And I'm going to put that one in the chat now.
Okay.
Now we know. Yeah. Hrilifshuri Nope.
Oh. No way. I think that's close.
No, I don't think so.
Hryf shuri.
Yeah, but you only can put the emphasis on the Hryf
shuri. Hryf shuri.
Yeah. I'm just making it worse. Let's just listen to Elise.
Hryf leaves hövdi.
Hryf shuri.
Just put the first emphasis on the first part. Hryf shuri. And then you just like blah.
I love that.
Hryf shuri. Yeah, I think we did okay, actually.
Shuri.
Hryf shuri. And now I don't have to say it anymore. That's the last time it's even in the script.
Last of it.
That's it. Anyway, that was the mountain that Double H settled by. But old Double H didn't stay there for long because he was killed by his slaves, who then ran off into hiding before Arnarson found them and took revenge for his blood brother. In the following decades, more chieftains followed, possibly to get away from King Harald of Norway. Harald was the son of the ruler of southeastern Norway, and he took over the dynasty from his dad at the tender age of 10.
Oh,
that's too young. You shouldn't be running anything at that point. But he was successful. He wound up making a bunch of conquests and unifying a chunk of western Norway, and he became the first king of Norway. The chieftains didn't love King Harald. I couldn't find much of what his policies were that were causing people to leave, but taxation was mentioned, so I imagine he's imposing taxes that people aren't liking. And so a lot of the clans and the leaders bailed out to the British Isles. Folks who wound up in Iceland may have also been avoiding him too, because it happened in his reign around the year 900 or so. When the Vikings first got to Iceland, it looked completely different than it does today. So now Iceland is known for its lava fields and being kind of gorgeously, I don't know, I don't want to say stark, because it's definitely beautiful and like there's greenery around and stuff, but it's very like bare and open. It's like stunningly beautiful. I mean, yeah. Incredible. Per this research paper I read from the American Anthropological Association, it's promoted as being timeless and untouched wilderness. Right. Hmm. So they're like, and this is how it's always been. This article kind of said there's a lot of like greenwashing in general that goes on in Iceland, which is basically appearing to be more green than you are in practice, which a ton of countries do. America doesn't, because we just don't even pretend. But
right.
Companies in America certainly do. And apparently, yeah, that's still kind of happening in Iceland. And they're kind of greenwashing the Vikings as well with this messaging, basically, is what I read. So a natural feature that you will not see a lot of in Iceland are trees. And it was not always that way. When the Vikings arrived in Iceland, it was actually covered in trees. One article I read said that about 60% of Iceland was birch forest. But the Vikings looked around at Iceland's forests and were like, these trees are in the way, have them removed. Obviously, they didn't do it for aesthetics. Vikings used wood to build ships and houses and shields and weapons, and plus, of course, to like burn in fires. And that worked totally fine over in Norway, where it's a little warmer and the climate is more sturdy. But Iceland's environment was a lot more fragile than Norway, and the island wound up rapidly deforested. The Vikings claimed all the potential farmland in the valleys and the lowlands within just 60 years, and within 100 years, a huge chunk of the land had been permanently stripped of trees. And more deforestation occurred later in the 18th century as well. It wasn't all the Vikings, but the Vikings definitely started it and put a good dent into it when they got there.
The two things in my mind, you're right, is that Iceland is just this bare environment, and then also we know that like wood and Vikings, like their boats, their houses, their everything, to not have the forethought to be like, maybe we should have some saplings that we take care of. Like, girl.
Yeah.
Like,
well, it worked for them so far, right? They were like, right, I mean, we do this in fucking Norway all the time. Like,
so
we
use why doesn't
the trees
it,
and then the trees grow back. Like, not a big deal.
Why isn't it happening? Yeah.
Yeah, and they do seem to have kind of like pulled back once they realized a little bit, but it was too late at that point. And the other thing they did, of course, was they brought agriculture and animals. They cleared out native plants to make room for farms where they planted a bunch of very non-native grains, and they brought a whole bunch of farm animals, horses, cows, sheep, pigs, and goats. They were all unleashed upon the land, and they ate up tons of the native flora. And the grazing of livestock in the highlands caused erosion, which in turn caused the loss of more vegetation. When vegetation is removed from soil, it dries out really quickly and it becomes much more likely to erode. And because the soil in Iceland's highlands is what's known as andesol, which is basically just volcanic soil, it is particularly prone to erosion. Iceland is estimated to have lost 40% of the soil that was present in the late 9th century, and a lot of this happened within the first two centuries of its settlement.
Dang, that's insane.
It's a lot. And all your trees.
All your trees.
And a lot of your native vegetation. A lot of the early crops wound up being abandoned. Eventually, they just kept cows, sheep, horses, and they grew hay. So it seems like they figured out that what they were doing wasn't going to work with the land that they were on, and they made some adjustments so that they could continue being productive. And they actually succeeded with this. They made the land better for farming than it was initially. Essentially, they like terraformed it from woodland into pasture land that was focused on sustaining grazing animals rather than growing crops like barley or whatever. And like I said, they did this very well, but it came at the expense of Iceland's natural environment. And it also resulted in social inequality. This information I got from that American Anthropological Association paper I mentioned earlier, which is called Were the Vikings Really Green? While Iceland's initial settlers got all that good land down in the valleys, those highland areas were way tougher to farm because of that fragile and quickly eroding volcanic soil. And this means that the people who got to Iceland later were stuck with highland farms that were more work for less payout. And as the environment kept suffering, highland farmers were forced to abandon their farms as they became, in some cases, completely unsustainable. And meanwhile, in the lowlands, they were actually benefiting from the erosion of the highlands because that soil was falling down into their areas and making it more productive and resilient in their land. And that means that the farmers on those lands were producing more and getting wealthier and wealthier. When the already poorer highland farmers had to bail on their farms and move to the lowlands, most of the good land was already taken. So they basically had two options. One, become tenant farmers, which you'll know all about if you heard our bonus episode about the boycott, the origin of the boycott. But basically, tenant farmers mean they don't own the land that they're farming. They rent it from the landowner, and they get to keep some amount of what they grow and some amount of the profit, but they also have to pay rent and give money and stuff to the landowner. So they could become tenant farmers, or they could become laborers for one of the other farms. And in that second scenario, they're not even renting the farmland. They're just working it and getting a wage, and that's it. As the wealthy became wealthier, they did what the wealthy do, and they kept acquiring more land until a wealthy minority in Iceland owned a majority of the farmland. And from the 15th to the early 20th centuries, there was a three-class system of laborers who owned no land, tenant farmers who rented land, and the wealthy landowners. And that actually kind of relates back to that classist Christmas cat that eats people who don't get new clothes.
Yeah.
So this farming system resulted in profound and long-lasting social inequality in Iceland, which was not helped by a civil war in the 13th century over whether they should become subjects of Norway or not. It was also not helped by a massive volcanic eruption in 1783, which wiped out 80% of their livestock and caused a widespread famine that killed 9,000 Icelanders.
Dang.
The social inequality that existed in Iceland got an overhaul in the 19th and 20th centuries. Farms are now mostly independent, generally fairly competitive with each other, like they're equal. And of course, now most folks work in, you know, cities and have urban jobs. Erosion is still an issue, but they're making efforts to fix that, and they're trying to manage grazing, as well as trying to do some reforestation, although that is going really, really slowly. They've got a strong economy, a lot of which is from tourism. People are coming to peek at this totally transformed island that's now legendarily gorgeous in its new state, which I'm not saying don't go to Iceland. I want to go.
No, I want to go too.
Love to go. The article that I read that I really enjoyed that I keep referencing refers to this state of Iceland as its second nature. So there was the first original nature of birch forests and, you know, original vegetation, but now the treeless farmland and the bare lava fields are the second nature, and that feels, well, natural. like that's how it's always been, right? I like the way that the anthropologists in this article put it, because it's like it's not necessarily strictly a degradation of the environment. It's an intentional transformation. Iceland isn't in its natural state anymore, and it never will be again. And right. it has environmental issues like erosion that may never heal, but like the land isn't degraded and unusable. It's in very high use. It's been repurposed. And the article encourages us to look at the big picture of this and how, you know, even though the social inequalities have been righted at this point, they existed for a really long time. And that's because of the way that the land was used. At this point, I'm going to quote this article that I'm obviously obsessed with. If the goal is to create a more just and equitable society within a robust and productive biosphere, initiatives towards sustainable development must formulate goals beyond simply the ability of a landscape to continue to produce in perpetuity. Sustainable landscapes are not necessarily biodiverse or ecologically flourishing, and pursuit of sustainability above all other concerns may lead to a society with limited resources in which production is strictly controlled and managed by a wealthy elite. So they're not saying this is the case currently in Iceland, but their point is that, you know, it was for a long time, and we should think about that as we develop areas.
Let's have a different idea of what a productive land and society looks like. Why must it be productive to be good? We keep coming back to this, you know?
Mm-hmm. And from so many different sources, you're like, well, yeah. This is the Vikings who weren't reading John Locke, obviously, because he wasn't around yet. But they still have this idea of like, oh, divine order of class, this idea of conquest and needing to produce more and more. And, you know, it's interesting. Trade.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know this isn't like the super grimmest ruin ever. It's a little environmental one, but it's bothered me since I learned about it. And yeah. like... the earth and the land don't need us. We need it. And we just continue to abuse it in ways that transform it into what we want out of it, not what it naturally wants to be, which is so egotistical and narcissistic. And I mean, like, this time of year, we grow trees specifically to be cut down so we can stick them in our houses and hang shiny shit on them and watch them slowly die. And though, for the record, before the Christmas tree lobby comes for me, the real Christmas trees are overall more environmentally friendly than fake Christmas trees are, just FYI. So, yeah, we will never know the true natural beauty of Iceland, the interesting species of plants and animals that might have developed on it. As we've done with so many parts of the world, we worked against nature, we bent it to our will, and we will never know what incredible natural wonders we have lost as a result. So... thanks a lot, Vikings. Rotting potatoes all around, and merry fucking Christmas.
I've loved this. I was in delight the whole time, especially how you ended it. I was like, are we doing a Kate Larkin swap? This is like a Larkin episode.
I know. I was channeling you a little bit while I was doing it. I was like, Larkin always has these great like conclusions and introductions. And I tried to get a great introduction and I was stalled out. But my conclusion I felt okay about. But yeah.
You should. I learned a lot. There's so many other things you could have ruined. I like that you took this route. So.
Well, thank you. Hopefully you all enjoyed it as well. Hopefully you had fun and you learned something and you can bring it to your families. And if you are feeling in the giving spirit, please consider supporting us on Patreon. There are lots of other far more worthy causes to support. But if you're already doing some of that and you have a little spare change and you want to toss it our way, we are, you know, always grateful for it. Our dreams of maybe getting to do this professionally someday are basically entirely hinged on the Patreon. And so since we have so many new listeners, please, please go support us. Please rate and review us. Tell your friends, tell your enemies. And we'll see you next time when we are going to be joined by an awesome new guest who you haven't heard from before, who is going to help us ruin New Year's. Merry Christmas, happy holidays, and go ruin something for somebody else. Go sing the new version of King Wenceslas.
Yeah, my version. Go moon a Starbucks.
By the time we release this, maybe that's not going on anymore. But anyway, Starbucks, you know, has been corporately evil for quite some time. So just moon them anyway. If you're in Seattle and you want a good local alternative to Starbucks, go to Snapdragon in West Seattle. And if you get lucky, you might even see Larkin.
You will, because I exist there.
All right. Love you.